Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'll be speaking today with Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal and The Story Paradox, How Our Love of Storytelling Builds Societies and Tears Them Down. And you can learn more at jonathangottschall.com. And I'm going to spell that. It's all one word, his first and last name, and I'm going to spell it for you. Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Gottschall, G-O-T-T-S-C-H-A-L-L, jonathangottschall.com. On Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. And we look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, and more, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. When I talked with today's guest back in 2012 about his book, The Storytelling Animal, the conversation was driven by questions like, why is story so powerful? And what can we do with what we're learning so that we can tap even more of the power of narrative? For the last couple of decades, I have actually taught storytelling and narrative to organizations, speeches, workshops, that sort of thing, a lot of them nonprofits and foundations. And the goal has been to help them connect with the public and with their members and motivate and persuade them to contribute to the good that the organization is doing in the world. But all that time, I've had a concern, a worry bubbling under the surface. If what I'm saying is true about the unique power of story to engage any audience, as I would say, from a Hollywood blockbuster to your annual report or your one-on-one conversations, then can't that same power be a force for evil? While he is in no way unique, though he does seem both a savant and an outsized practitioner, Donald Trump has brought this realization and this threat home to us all. I turned to my wife during his first debate with Hillary Clinton in 2016 and said, "We are in big trouble. He's a narrative machine." Everything he said fit into a few large stories on which his apparent worldview and his campaign and subsequent administration were based, about immigrants and elites, about people being left behind, and about himself as the sole solution. Only I can fix it. For months before and since his defeat over a year ago, he has relentlessly told us another story, the big lie of a rigged federal election. Jonathan Gottschall shares both my enthusiasm about the power of story for good and my trepidation about the dark potential of that same power. In The Story Paradox, he declares storytelling the best method we've ever devised for manipulating each other by circumventing rational thought. And he contends that behind all civilization's greatest ills, environmental destruction, runaway demagogues, warfare, you will always find a mind-disordering story. And he argues that societies succeed or fail depending on how well they manage these tensions between the power of story for good or for bad. And as new technologies amplify the effects of disinformation campaigns, conspiracy theories, fake news, it becomes nearly impossible to separate fact from fiction. I've often counseled folks, change the story to change the world. In his new book, Gottschall calls on us to stop asking how we can change the world through stories and start asking before it's too late, how can we save the world from stories? Jonathan Gottschall is a distinguished fellow in the English department at Washington and Jefferson College, and his work has been featured in top journals. And he's the author or editor of 8 books, including The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human, and his latest, The Story Paradox, How Our Love of Storytelling Builds Societies and Tears Them Down. And as I said, you can learn more at jonathangottschall.com. Welcome again, Jonathan Gottschall, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terrence. That was a great introduction. I wish you could just keep going for the rest of the hour. So I don't think I can top the cogency of all that.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. One of my questions often is any comments about the introduction, but thank you. You've already done it.
Yeah.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, February 8th. Now, having been with me once before, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So tell us, you know, what comes top of mind today to you about your path to the work you do today. And I don't mean just from the last book to this book, but go back as far as you want and mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision.
Yeah.
I would say one thing that I note in your work is, and it's been interesting, I've noticed it in a few people that I've dealt with over the years, you start in your adult work, at least, and I'm saying you can take it back further than that, but you start in your adult work fairly much within the academic confines of study and publication, and you then move toward a outreach to a more popular public. But take us back as far as you want and let us know a little bit about Jonathan Gottschall.
Oh, okay. That's always challenging to do. I guess I would start back in graduate school. I went to graduate school to pursue a PhD in English literature. And I was very ambitious about creating knowledge and understanding what literature was and where the power of stories came from. And when I got to graduate school, I was very quickly disillusioned, because almost everyone around me, this was the height of the sort of postmodern era, almost everyone around me believed that it was sort of impossible to figure anything out. You know, we couldn't know anything. We couldn't learn anything. I didn't know how these people got out of bed in the morning and came to work. So I started to look around and cast around for ways of developing more reliable and durable knowledge about anything, including knowledge in the humanities. And I quickly sort of stumbled over the scientific method. You know, this is a really, and so I started asking myself, is the sort of consensus in my field that everything is qualitative and nothing will reduce to number? Is there any actual validity to that? And I tried to sort of develop a science of storytelling to advance some of our questions through scientific means. And I sort of joined a pioneering movement in that world. And that gradually snowballed into a whole new interdisciplinary effort in the science of stories, pulling in, neuroscientists and psychologists and communication scholars and sociologists and some literary quants, people trying to apply scientific methods from within the discipline of literary studies. And the books that I've written, the last couple of books I've written, The Storytelling Animal and The Story Paradox, are sort of popularizations of that effort. And one of the reasons I moved towards popularization was because I found life within the confines of academia overly confining. The sort of work I did wasn't very popular within academic departments. It was seen as sort of dangerous, sort of uncomfortable. And so I've moved basically out of academia, and now I write popular books full time.
Yeah, let me say, one of the things I remember in your writing was noting that academic literature, academic publication, is anti-personal experience, anti-story. And let me just share very briefly, my wife went to Penn's program on positive psychology. Mm-hmm. The MAP program, Masters of Applied Positive Psychology, which is, pretty radical in terms of academic pursuits. But on her first paper, and she's a former sitcom writer, and she was trying to popularize some of what she would learn there, right? That was her goal in going to graduate school. But her first paper, they said, you have been scored down for using anecdote and personal metaphor and personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, ice water on your face. It was, wait a minute, that's what makes writing and communicate, all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but what we're saying about academia is true. They are against that, yes?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the sciences are certainly against it. The sciences have sort of an embargo on anecdote and storytelling, and actually for very good reasons. And some of the reasons that I discuss in the book, that stories for all the good they do are also masters of manipulation. We tell stories to each other partly because we want to evoke certain emotions toward getting certain outcomes. And so the science is sort of put an embargo on storytelling within scientific papers because they wanted arguments to succeed and fail based upon the merits and the rational merits and not sort of whatever powerful emotions might be evoked or what pretty images might be evoked.
Yeah, no, I was struck actually by your defense of that because it makes sense. As you say, storytelling can make us drop our guard, can do all sorts of things to our mind that you don't want in a scientific in the pursuit of science. Let's turn now to I mentioned in the introduction that we shared, I could see, this same thing of celebrating story in the work I was doing, in the book you wrote, The Storytelling Animal, but being haunted kind of by this, nagging voice in the back of our mind that says, but what if it turns dark? Was there a moment when you said, I've got to write this book? What was there a first
Yes.
itch that needed to be scratched?
Yes. I'll give you the first itch and the second itch. So if I forget
Okay.
my second itch, make sure to remind me.
Okay.
The first itch was, like you, I had written the book The Storytelling Animal. And like you, I had been absorbed into something that I call facetiously the storytelling industrial complex. Mm-hmm. So I had also been going out on the road weekend after weekend and giving keynotes and consulting and talking to organizations, some of which were very wholesome and positive, and teaching them the fundamentals of story science and also talking a bit about the art and the craft side of it. And also talking to a lot of businesses, some of which, in retrospect, I don't think were quite so wholesome.
Mm-hmm.
And the message that I was delivering, and other people like yourself in the storytelling industrial complex are delivering, is that stories are good. They're these wonderful sources for, delivering messages and generating empathy and all of the good associations we have with storytelling. But I also, became more and more aware of the dark sides of storytelling. And it was kind of naive of me to take so long to become fully aware of it. I would say the second itch came about 3 to 4 years ago, I can't remember exactly, when I woke up one morning and learned that a man who was practically a neighbor of mine, he lived about 15 miles away, had fallen down this internet rabbit hole. And down that rabbit hole, he learned that Jews were the great vampires of history. And believing that story, as he did, he got into his truck and he drove the short drive into the Squirrel Hill neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Again, not very far from where I live. And he enters into the Tree of Life Synagogue and he begins shooting the place up, screaming, "All Jews must die." He kills 11 people, he wounds many more, and it's all because he's living inside this incredibly old and incredibly dumb story of Jewish evil. And from within that story, what he did made a demented sort of sense. And that was the moment where I decided I needed to write this book, mm-hmm. because that incident is such a powerful microcosm of the power that stories have to really just engulf our brains and drive us towards madness. One of the claims my book makes is that there's this great law of history. And the law goes something like this, that monsters behave like monsters all the time. But to get good people to behave monstrously, you first have to tell them a story. You have to tell them a big lie, a dark conspiracy, some sort of all-encompassing religious mythology, political mythology, the kind of fiction story that turns bad things, like shooting up a synagogue, into a good thing, at least into the from the mind and the point of view of the shooter. And so this is the story paradox my book explores, that stories are very simply the best and most constructive force in the world, And at the very same time, they're absolutely the worst and most destructive force in the entire world. And in general, our culture takes account of all the positive sides of storytelling while genuinely not seeming to notice much of the negative side of it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. I'm going to say a couple of things. One, I'm not sure that they don't notice the negative, because obviously there's so much, especially nowadays, about disinformation, misinformation, the power of social media to stimulate the emotions with these irritating tales that can engulf people. So I think there's actually, perhaps with social media and with how bad it's gotten, there is, I think, more of a realization. But as you say, you were spreading the gospel, as it were, for years before you said, wait, I've got to put a warning label.
Yes.
I was doing this. I have been doing the same. You know, adding a little caveat somewhere in a 1 hour or 3 hour presentation that they can also be used for darkness. I suspect that some of the reason that the study or the analysis or the reckoning with the dark side is just how difficult the challenge is.
Yeah. I mean, I would say a couple things. People are aware of the problem of disinformation, propaganda, conspiracy theories, all this stuff. They tend to think it applies to the other side, not to their side. Mm. They don't think this is an us problem. They think it's a them problem. One of the things I'm trying to get people to admit in the book is that this is not just a problem of the right or the left or the people on the other side of the divide. This is an everyone problem. This is we all have a tendency to get misled by narrative. The other thing to say about this is that people are aware of these problems, but I'm not really sure that they're aware that they're rooted in narrative psychology. And narrative psychology, I define as this, the study of how our brains naturally shape stories and are naturally shaped by stories. And so you can get people and you can bring them into a lab and you can just ask them and say, what, you know, do stories have any influence over you, over how you think and feel and behave? And they'll say, no. What influences me is logical, rational stuff. I'm influenced by facts, by science, by statistics. But, you know, with respect, those people are wrong. The story science leaves little reasonable doubt that stories have this special, unique power to rouse us emotionally, to rivet our attention, and to change how we think and we feel. But ironically, it's this bozo confidence that most people have that stories don't influence us is what gives them such powerful and I think quite dangerous influence over us.
That makes sense. And I got to say, when I came upon that assertion in your writing, it surprised me. I figure that by now, most people know that stories have outsized influence. When I started dealing with story was many years ago. I started I come out of screenwriting. And so I thought, oh, this is something I can teach to help, you know, folks I believe in do their work better. It was like 2004, but there weren't a lot of people talking about story. There weren't a lot of books about story in this vein. But that it seemed to me that as it has become a buzzword and on people's lips a lot, that I assumed that people knew that.
Yeah.
And not just based on their lived experience, kind of watching what was happening, but also, you know, there's been a lot of, as I said, cultural and media attention over those last 15 years. Is the evidence that they do what you said they do out there? I mean, it's not just anecdotal. It's like people have studied this and you know, 77% of people say, no, they don't influence me at all or hardly at all.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, there's studies on this. Now, they're saying they don't influence me at all. They might totally agree that they influence you. So one thing, you know, I kind of felt lucky when my book came out that I was coming out with an argument that almost everyone, regardless of where they sat on the political spectrum, would agree with. And this is what they would agree with. Those people on the other side of my political divide, ideological divide, whatever.
Religious divide.
Yeah. Religious divide. Those people on the other side, they are hopelessly lost inside fiction. People on the right think this of people on the left. People on the left think this of people on the right. It's the one thing we can agree on in these highly polarized times. But we're not very skeptical of the narrative. So again, one of the big fears I had when I was writing this book, and I would imagine it was a sort of nightmarish image of people reading the book and kind of happily nodding along as they ticked off all the ways that my ideas and these arguments apply to the people and to the ideas and the stories that they don't like, while never thinking to turn that skepticism around on themselves. And I think most people are guilty of this. I think it's very, very hard for us to question our own stories.
Yeah, we're like fish in water, right?
And
let me just question one other thing. You started the last point a couple of minutes ago with the statement that monsters behave like monsters all the time. What does that actually mean? Because it seems to me that that second, the corollary, which is that you got to do something to turn good people into monsters, even temporarily, that what we see are monstrous acts, monstrous actions, monstrous, even long drawn out campaigns and so on. And is it really helpful to separate the person who does that from someone who you're saying is a monster? I mean, is a monster Kaczynski? Is a monster Dahmer? Who is a monster?
That's what I was thinking of. Yeah, I was thinking of people who were sort of congenitally broken. You know, somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, for instance, who's, you know, fairly monstrous. Even someone, I don't know if, you know, Hitler was born a monster or if he was made into a monster by the stories he told and the stories he consumed. But I'm just saying that when you have instances of mass horror, something like the slave trade or the Holocaust or the genocide in the Americas, these were carried out by people exactly like us. These people were not congenitally broken. These were people that had narratives in their heads, like the Tree of Life shooter did, that transformed really bad things into good things, at least from the point of view of that narrative. So one of the things that I'm actually striving for in the book is a more radical sort of empathy than most of us are used to striving for. So we're used to and we're familiar with this idea of that we should be empathetic towards the wretched of the earth, people who are poor, oppressed, enchained, immiserated. And the sort of moral the moral obligation of this is encompassed in that famous phrase, "There but for the grace of God go I." But when it comes to the bad guys of history, when it comes to the malefactors, when it comes to the conquistadors and the slavers and the inquisitors, we have a sort of failure of empathetic imagination. We won't allow ourselves to imagine that that is where we would have gone to if not for the grace of God, quite obviously. So I think that the devil isn't the other. The devil is us. The devil is who we would have been if born into those circumstances.
Yeah, I do think, by the way, in many cases, we do have an empathy or a quote, understanding of people based on their circumstances. But what you're saying is, and their circumstances not only applies to their poverty or their situation at home, but the stories they were exposed to and the stories that surrounded them, right? That
yes.
We take that into account as another circumstance.
Yeah, that's right. And this is a difficult thing to talk about, especially like, you know, in this sort of format. This is really where you really need a book because the book, you can lay it out at length and you can talk about all the caveats and you won't forget anything because this is sort of dangerous territory. But if you take an episode, you know, if you take the most extreme example of human evil that will come to mind for most of us is, you know, Nazism, and, you know, its most extreme expression in the Holocaust. And were all these Germans monsters? Were they all congenital, you know, homicidal maniacs? I don't think that's a useful way of looking at it. Obviously, they were living inside this fascist version of the Truman Show, where all of their inputs, all the stories they heard, all the news, all the propaganda was telling them the same story of Jewish evil. And it was a very hard illusion to see through. And even if you did see through it, did you have the courage to resist? Did you have the courage to risk your life?
But Hannah Arendt, I mean, I think, you know, what if people know her name, mm-hmm. I think it's for most people, I think it's because she was one of the first to point out the banality of evil.
Yeah.
The banality of the mundane, everyday German who, if he wasn't actively participating, he or she actively participating, neither was he or she actively resisting.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And again, the only thing I'd be tempted to quibble with a little bit is the notion of evil. If you're living inside, I mean, it was evil. I mean, for sure it was evil. But from their point of view and from the stories that they're living inside, they don't see themselves as mustache twirling, you know, mm-hmm. cackling mm-hmm. villains. They see themselves as the good guys of history. They're inside this incredibly powerful story that told them that they were, you know, Aryan knights in making humanity's last great stand against the forces of evil. They thought they were fighting evil. The guy, the Tree of Life shooter, is That's inside right. a story where he thinks, hey, I know this looks bad, shooting up this synagogue full of geriatric worshipers, but look closer. I'm the good guy. I'm not genocidal. I'm the guy who's stopping the genocide by killing these bad people.
I'm risking
again, this
everything.
Is totally I'm twisted.
I'm either likely or perhaps martyring myself to do this deed.
Yes, he sees himself as a self-sacrificing, altruistic hero.
And anyone who finds that too extreme, we obviously are seeing that in the way that people hold what happened at the Capitol on January 6th, 2021.
Exactly. Yeah.
The people who stormed and beat policemen and guards to break in thought of themselves as the patriots. I have myself, and you may do the same, on some right-wing email digest so that I get, you know, I get the messages to join Donald Trump's social media platform and so on. But I'm yeah. usually addressed in those as fellow patriot.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And that's the story. Let me just read a couple of quotes here. You say that psychologist Melanie Green and Tim Brock argue that entering fictional worlds radically alters the way information is processed. The more absorbed readers are in a story, the more the story changes them. Highly absorbed readers, and they're using readers, but I think it's very clear that this is listeners, this is viewers.
Yes.
This is... you know, however you're getting your information, this is in conversation with your neighbor. And the highly absorbed audience, let's call it that, detect significantly fewer false notes, inaccuracies, or missteps than those who are less caught up in it. And the statement, I don't know if it's yours or theirs, is people are no more to blame for the smart or dumb stories that fill their heads than depressions in the earth are to blame when they fill up with pure or fetid water.
Yeah. Yeah, the second quote is mine. Mm-hmm. But going back to the quote from Green and Brock. Who's it? Is it Green and Brock? Yes, that's right. This is really important because they're talking about highly absorbed readers. So one of the things I've been saying and you've been saying, and it's what we both said in our days in the storytelling industrial complex, is that stories have this really special power as a form of messaging. When it comes to just about anything that a messenger, a communicator could care about, Do people like the message? Do they pay attention? Do they remember it? Are they persuaded? Do they pass it along through their own social networks? Stories outcompete other forms of messaging. But there's this big catch that that quote sort of touches upon. And the catch is that none of this actually works. None of these special advantages of stories kick in unless the story is actually good. And what a literary critic or a film critic means by good is soupy, subjective, it's hard to define. What ordinary people mean by good is it casts the spell of narrative transportation. And narrative transportation is possibly the most important and certainly the best studied subject in story science. And narrative transportation is this delicious phenomenon. It's one of our favorite things about being human. You come home from work, you turn on your favorite TV show, you pick up a novel you can't love, and you instantly teleport out of your own mundane, boring, perhaps quite painful life and into these alternative story worlds. And when we're in these worlds, it's an authentically altered state of consciousness. It's like taking a drug. And the drug, you know, the psychoactive effects of the drug gives you this incredibly rapt attention. We can pay very close attention when we're in storyland, oftentimes for hours on end. Mm-hmm. And it's also this state of high suggestibility. People are far more open-minded when they're in storyland, which is a nice way of putting it and accounts for all the good things stories do. But the darker way of putting it is people are a lot more gullible. They're easier to mold and easier to manipulate, which is why propagandists, fake news artists, disinformation campaigns, conspiracy theories, demagoguery, these are all transmitted in the form of storytelling, because it's such a powerful tool for manipulating and misleading people.
Okay. Let me tell people, by the way, this is Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally, speaking today with Jonathan Gottschall, author of The Storytelling Animal, and the new book is The Story Paradox, How Our Love of Storytelling Builds Societies and Tears Them Down. And you can learn more at jonathangottschall.com. That's J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Jonathan Gottschall, G-O-T-T-S-C-H-A-L-L, jonathangottschall, all one word, .com. And you can find him at Jonathan Gotch on Twitter. So let me put that for you. It's Jonathan, just as it was before, but the Gottschall stops after the S-C-H. So it's Jonathan, G-O-T-T-S-C-H. So at Jonathan G-O-T-C-H. I wanted to talk just a little bit about, we've been referring to it sort of, but talk just a little bit about some of the foundation here on which we then ask the question, good or ill, which is the power of story. And we've talked about it somewhat, but one thing that you said, which I had a little trouble with, but let's talk about it, was you said the purpose of all communication is to sway the other. And that since story is a form of communication, that the purpose of every story is to sway another. And just on the communication one, do you really, do you feel the need to say there is only one reason and this is the reason? And if so, it seems to me there may be more, because if one defines communication as, if one defines every communication as, the, you know, to sway, then it's almost meaningless.
Right.
So just speak to that for a second for me.
Well, I think there's all kinds of sway. Early in the book, that sway is the overriding goal of virtually all communication, including. And I say that storytelling isn't just one way that human beings compete for sway, for influence in the world. It's our most powerful way of sway. They're so hard that we may stay bent forever. And this is a good thing when stories. Enormous capacity for good is channeled to promote empathy, understanding, charity, peace, all that good stuff. But that swayful magic of storytelling is just as good at channeling division. And so when I say story, I mean, when I say sway, influence, all communication, or virtually all communication, I think maybe the resistance you're feeling is the negative connotations of the word sway. you know, like you're trying to get over on people. But we use words for a reason. We're trying to create some sort of influence in the world. We want to move people to think like we do, or to pass us the ketchup, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I do think that just about everything that comes out of our mouth is in one way or another aimed toward producing some sort of influence in the world.
Yeah, the way I used to put it in workshops was, I would say, when you're communicating for your organization, within your organization, in your business, then, you know, what I said was, the purpose of every communication is to make a specific individual take a specific action, you know. But I was leaving out that there's probably, you know, some communication that is spontaneous, that's this, that's that, and so on. So what you're saying
I tried to think of something.
It may not be universal, but it's close.
I hedged my language just slightly there. in the early versions of that, I made it universal, that everything people said was sway. And then I hedged it a little bit because some of my readers, you know, fought back against it. My sort of the people, you know, who read it before publication.
Yeah.
But no, I'm tempted. I mean, can you think of any instance off the top of your head where humans communicate without an effort to sway?
Well, I sort of think that then it almost doesn't mean anything if the reason that I say something to you is because ultimately I want you to like me, notice me, want to spend time with me again later, those sorts of things, which I mean, you know, you could take the most mundane communication and say, but that's got to be, you know, that's at least going on there, that it almost becomes meaningless because, you know, so, but yeah. Okay, let's leave that aside. I just wanted to touch on it. And as you say, if there is a purpose to communication, it's to sway.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, I think also part of what you're saying, when you say like, if everything is sway, you know, nothing's sway, it becomes sort of meaningless. I sort of agree with you. I found this, you know, when I had this sort of insight, I found it both profound, and I say this in the book, I found it both profound and profoundly banal.
Right.
You know, so.
I thought that was a good admission on your part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then this is going to seem like a digression, but what about subtext? In a book called Improvisation in the Theater, which I highly recommend, by the way, it's a British author who was in the theater world, Keith Johnstone. And he teaches in that book that every scene is a negotiation about status. So he makes it even more specific in a way.
Huh.
And not only do I tend to agree, and having written screenplays, but a quite successful screenwriter who I sort of mentored a bit in his younger years cites that one line as the key to his success. Any thoughts?
So the line is that
every scene is a negotiation about status.
Well, I find it highly plausible.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't. I my temptation now is to start, you know, bludgeoning my memory banks, trying to think of counterexamples. But off the top of my head, no, I think that's really provocative and interesting.
So what it says to me then is that there's a subtext sometime where the thing is, you know, not past the ketchup, but boy, that was a great ball game. When in fact, by subtext is, if I can draw you in a little closer, I might be able to, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I think what we're both saying, though, is that we've got room for subtext. A communication might not always mean what it specifically says, but even in that form, it's probably got a purpose, and that purpose is probably to move that other person in some direction.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, even things like the example I gave in the book of that is sort of like small talk.
Yeah.
You know, you meet a stranger on a plane and you make small talk. What is this for? You're never going to see this person again. But it's just a way of, you know, kind of breaking down social barriers and making friends with someone.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also said recently that the more powerful the story, the more the story can transport us, the more it does all those things that it uniquely sort of does, which is clouds our critical faculties and makes us more gullible and all that sort of thing. Now, in that same example where you had that insight about sway, you're talking about everyone in a bar you're sitting in.
Yeah.
You're alone, hoping to make some sort of breakthrough on your book, or at least drink yourself out of caring whether you do or not. And you notice that everybody's doing the same thing, and you say that what they're all doing is telling stories.
Yeah.
And I just want to quibble on that one too, because
yeah,
I have noticed that when I was teaching story, an awful lot of, even when people were given a very clear assignment, write a story, and even when they've been told, you know, a good story usually has some obstacles to be overcome, a goal, a protagonist, some conflict, they would give me, in response, what I would call fragments of stories, outlines of stories, bits of stories. Speak to that just a bit.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with you. And I'm glad, actually, you're pushing back against some of my claims, and possibly maybe I have a tendency in some of these scenes to kind of overstate. I don't know. But I welcome the push. One thing, you know, so I'm in the bar. I'm looking around, and I'm kind of, I'm having a drink, and I'm kind of making notes for the book. And I'm noticing that everyone in the bar is doing the exact same thing. What I said they're actually doing, I can't remember what I said in the book, but they're talking. Everyone in the bar is talking. I'm like, what are they saying? What is there to communicate? The people on the TV are talking. The bartenders are talking. And at some point, I guess I say that, you know, they're trading stories back and forth. And one thing that psychologists have done is they've gone to natural human settings, like this bar, and or like the water cooler at work, or like a cafe, and they just listened in to human conversation in natural settings, and what the heck are they talking about? And for the most part, they're telling stories. And those stories are within, actually, a defined genre. And about 70% of it is gossip.
Mm.
Did you hear what she did? Did you hear what he did? What a jerk! You know, that kind of thing. So they're telling stories. Yeah, they're kind of fragmentary. You know, it's not like you're going to narrate on and on for minutes or hours on end. But it's like, hey, how have you been? Oh, we're okay. We went to blah blah blah. You know, these aren't great stories, but they meet the definition of a story. What's a story? A story, the most basic definition of what a story is. A story is what happened. It's what happened. Whether it was a children's, you know, a description of a child's make-believe session, or what happened in in history.
Let me jump in for a second, because obviously this is something you and I have both thought about. One is that Ira Glass's format for This American Life story, which I assume you've probably come across, is then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, this is what it means.
Yeah.
Then this happened, then this happened, this then this happened, this is what we learned. And he says, without that, this is what it means, or this is what we learned, it's not going to be an effective story. It's just going to be an anecdote.
I totally agree.
Yeah.
The second part, the first part of the definition of a story is it's what happened.
Right.
But for it to be the kind of story we care about, it has to be doing more than that. Stories aren't just accounts of what happened. They're accounts of what it all meant. And so story is the natural tool. And I mean natural like in a biological sense. Story is a natural tool that human beings use to process raw events and raw information into something that humans desperately need, which is meaning.
Yeah. And by the way, if we go back to our earlier contention about the power of conspiracy stories and those sorts of things, it is the meaning which ends up motivating the person, I believe, right? Then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, and it's because the elites don't care about you, and
right.
And it's because the Jews wanted that sort of thing, and it's the meaning piece that actually seems to me to have the motivating power.
Yeah, I agree with you. These are deeply meaningful stories, and it's one of the reasons people don't want to give them up, because they inject so much meaning into your life. Who are you? Well, I'm a guy, I'm in the QAnon community, and I'm saving the world from vampire, pedophile, cannibals, you know? And if you try to take that story away from people, you're taking away this vision of themselves as people who are on a heroic quest in a band of brothers and sisters. One of the things that's so poignant to me about the QAnon movement is one of their main phrases. It's where we go one, we go all.
Yes.
You know, there's a sense of community and friendship. And to give up the story is to admit that you, it's not to give up the story, it's to admit that you were in a different story all along. One where you and your friends weren't the questing heroes, you were the fools and the marks. And this is something that, you know, that's the kind of story that people really desperately resist giving up.
Yeah, and also, on the one hand, it's admitting you were wrong. On the other hand, it's giving up your belonging.
Yeah, your whole community is destroyed. And in fact, it's worse than that. You might even become sort of an enemy of your
that's
community.
That's right. Of your, yeah. Yeah, of those who you were closest to and who you would fight for. I mean, we know that in war, people usually say that they were not fighting for their nation. They were not fighting for the empire. Yeah. They were fighting for the guy next to them.
That's right.
And so that sense of belonging is crucial. So one thing that we've gotten to, and we've got about 7 or 8 minutes left, is the power of, part of the power of the story has to do with the quest. And the quest usually has to do with the conflict, and the conflict usually has to do with villains. So talk a bit about the danger of our addiction to villains in our stories, and let's take this into the possibilities of solutions, or at least ways of trying to chart a new path forward.
Yeah, this is very near the heart of my concerns. Again, part of what my book was trying to pivot off of was this feeling that most of us have that storytelling is good, that it's just this simple force for good in the world. And one of the main pieces of data people pull out to support that view is the idea that stories are our most powerful way of generating empathy. They are the way that we build connections and build bridges across our divides, and they promote charity and peace and all this other good stuff. And people have been saying this forever, and the research actually supports it. But this idea is both true and it's good, and it's completely 100%, not 100%, but it's completely one-sided, because stories in the act of generate all that empathy also are really good at generating empathy's inverse, which is a sort of moral blindness to the humanity of whoever we force into that villain's role. This way of thinking takes account of all those good feelings, those warm feelings, those empathetic feelings, without noticing that there's a very different sort of energy circulating through stories, and it's circulating fast, and it's circulating hard, and it wouldn't be wrong to call that energy hate. We hate the villain of the story. We want to see this person punished. We feel good when they're punished. We feel let down when the villain escapes or is let off the hook or is rehabilitated or is not punished. So everything that makes story such a wonderful tool for building connection across divides also is what makes story a wonderful tool for destroying those connections across our divides. And the tendency to villainize is really at the heart of that.
Okay. And since it does seem that one of the things that gives story their power and makes a story a good story or a great story or a powerful story is, you know, the classic structure. A protagonist has a goal, but there are obstacles. As I tell folks, if your organization sets a goal and you accomplish it by going step one, step two, step three, that's a great goal. That's a great accomplishment. It's not a good story. It's conflict. And conflict then seems, and the overcoming of obstacles is where we build our involvement in the story. We begin to lose ourselves in it and so on. And very often that needs a villain. If not a personified villain, then a villainous system or a villainous condition or something like that. And I, let me say that when I was a screenwriter, this did occur to me a long time ago, that if the most important message really that we want to, that I want to as a human being, not as a screenwriter necessarily, but as a human being, want to see us realize and gravitate toward and so on, it's that we are all one, that we are connected, that we're interdependent, that we're not tribes, that we're not separate, that we, you know, that the big problems we face, climate change, nuclear weapons, pandemics, are about this oneness, and that we all actually came from the Big Bang. You know, take it as far as you want. I found that a challenge to come up with stories that I thought were going to be compelling for screenplays that taught oneness were really hard to come up with.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a problem built right into the structure of storytelling. The way I put it in the book is that, you know, it's a sort of series of sentences. People need stories. Stories need problems. Problems need villains to cause them. And so there is a sense in which stories are really good at drawing people together into more cohesive mm-hmm. units, into communities. They define who the people are and what our values are and what the good guys are like. But that, they often do so by defining the good people in relation to the bad people. And so they define the other as well. And they often encourage us to hate, ostracize, punish the other. And so this is a problem. You know, humans are storytelling animals. We're not going to escape this.
Right.
But we have to learn how to tell stories in a way that is more constructive and less divisive. So one of the things, you know, that I suggest in the book that we all need to work on is we need to continue telling stories, because stories really do have these wonderful capacities people talk about. They really can bring us together into that oneness that you're talking about, but only if we can resist telling them in ways that are guaranteed not to work. So if we want to really build these bridges of narrative, rather than just blowing up the few bridges we have left, we have to particularly avoid this giddy, deeply human temptation to see ourselves as the heroes and to see people across the divide from us as sort of the flattened out villains in our morality tales. And I think this is what we're doing. This is what polarization is. It's this very primitive way of thinking. And
It's tribalism, I think.
Yeah. And it's very
and
good.
And tribalism almost by definition says, we are my tribe, they are not.
Yes. Tribalism, this way of thinking is very good at electrifying the in-group, at electrifying the tribe. But it's not really a recipe for social progress. It's certainly not a recipe for the sort of compromise that a democracy needs to actually function. What I think it is a way of prosecuting a cold civil war of storytelling that's threatening day by day to escalate towards something much worse.
So, if we've gotten to this point, and we've got a couple of minutes left, you've been thinking about this more than I have. I've been thinking about the problem, but not about, as I say, I had trouble seeing where the path toward solution was. You advocate one, I think your number one thing is to, you know, maybe realize the conflicting powers of story. But two would then be to examine our own surrender to story, our mm-hmm. own, the flaws in our own stories and so on. But what else?
Well, what I'm most worried about, and I think what a lot of people are most worried about today, is polarization. Mm-hmm. The fact that we're just at each other's throats, the fact that we're not living in the same reality. So the main thing I would like to see both sides do is cut it out with the villainization. Stop caricaturing each other. Stop dehumanizing each other by turning each other into villains. And I think it's conceivable that this isn't just a matter of personal choice. Like, I decide not to villainize you. You decide not to villainize me. Maybe we can actually develop norms around telling stories that don't dehumanize our opponents. But you know, before we went on the air, we talked just briefly, and you said that you were a little worried that the solutions I propose to the problems are inadequate. And I'm concerned about that as well. Mm-hmm. I floundered around trying to think of a way out of these problems. And I ended up, you know, back reading Plato's Republic, which was written 2,400 years ago. And he's dealing with exactly the same issues. 2,400 years ago, Plato already had his hair on fire about the danger of story to individual minds and to a whole society, the way it can drive a whole society into an epidemic of irrationality. And he comes up with extreme solutions to the problem. One problem is, well, maybe we should just take all the storytellers out to the edge of town, throw them over the city wall, and we'll just banish them all, and we'll live in a complete utopia of rationality. It's like, ah, that won't work. So his other plan is, well, maybe we'll just take all storytelling and put it totally under the control of the state. These are ways that you could actually harness and control the power of story, but they're so nightmarish, you know, that you wouldn't actually want to entertain them. And no society has really ever wanted to go as far as Plato wanted to go. But I don't know what we do. I don't know if we can get out of this. The original ending to my book, and I changed it because it was so pessimistic, was something like this. Let me see if I can remember. It's obvious, you know, humans are storytelling animals. It's obvious we can't live without stories, but as technology continues to amplify their power, it's starting to seem like we can't live with them either.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final line is something like, this is a book about stories. It's not a storybook. Who says we get a happy ever after?
Oh! And then you went back to the bar. Oh, yeah. Well, one thing you do say is hate and resist the story, but try not to hate the storyteller.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling it's not going to change, you know, the vectors or the direction or anything, but it's a step in the right direction.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, the first thing, my grand hope for the book is to draw attention to this issue, to draw attention to this problem, to get a swarm of other smart people interested in this and doing research on it. I don't necessarily feel like I have to figure it all out, but I do hope that other people will come on board and we can start working towards solutions that are workable, because I do think that these problems are existential, that if we can't get the psychology of storytelling under some sort of control, we are in serious danger, not just as a nation, but as a species.
Right. So in a sense, this is offered as a beginning, as a signpost, more than a conclusion.
Yes. Because everything that I'm covering in the book is very new. The science of stories that I draw upon is maybe a couple of decades old. And it's all in the process of still taking shape and still being discovered and figuring out what the implications of all this are going to be.
Right.
So again, the goal is to draw interest and draw the attention of people, you know, who might help come up with solutions.
Very good. So again, the new book is The Story Paradox, How Our Love of Storytelling Builds Society and Tears Them Down. The website is jonathangottschall.com. I'll spell it for you one more time. Jonathan, J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, Gottschall, G-O-T-T-S-C-H-A-L-L, jonathangottschall.com. And you can find Jonathan on Twitter at Jonathan Gottsch. That's G-O-T-T, Jonathan, G-O-T-T-S-C-H. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, T-E-R-R-E-N-C-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y.net, or a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 or so articles to flesh out the conversation, You can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform Podcast on Apple Podcasts and at most major podcast sites. And you'll find years of podcasts at my site or those sites. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, George Packard. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence, McNally Terence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in Productions, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Jonathan Gottschall. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence, for having me on. Until next time.